This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, a man who likes to get stung by insects to measure the pain. Ouch. But first, there's a lot of talk about which country will emerge as the next superpower. Pundits analyze GDP, exports, economic stability. Some experts look at military power. There was one list out this week that put China ahead of everyone else, and it was not looking at any of those indicators. It's the top 500 list, as it's called, and it looked at the country's total number of supercomputers. Here to tell us why that indicator matters is Amy Nordstrom. She's an associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum here in New York. Welcome back, Amy.
Hi, Ira.
Okay, how many supercomputers does China have?
China now officially has 167 supercomputers, surpassing the U.S. for the first time in history, which has 165.
Wow. So that's how we rate the number of supercomputers at?
Well, you could also rank it by the fastest, and China beats us out on that as well. China has the top performing, most powerful supercomputer in the world, and also the second most powerful. And the remarkable thing about China is back in 2001, it had no supercomputers on the top 500 list. So it has come a long way very quickly.
I remember when it was Cray computers and they measured it. And are they American made or do they totally make them in China?
That is a great question. So now the top performing supercomputer, which is located in China, is for the first time made completely with Chinese processors. And this is a very big deal because about a year ago, the U.S. actually blocked the shipment of Intel processors from the U.S. to Chinese supercomputer labs. So it prohibited China from having access to U.S. made processors. So China started making their own. And now they've actually built the most powerful supercomputer in the world with Chinese made processors, which is pretty remarkable.
Wow. So they're moving very quickly.
They are. They are. The U.S., the blockage was out of concern that the Chinese government might be using supercomputers for crunching metadata for surveillance purposes. And China says their newest supercomputer, the most powerful one, is going to be used for things like weather monitoring and research and engineering and manufacturing. So we'll see if that's the case.
So they say, if you don't sell it to us, we'll build our own.
That's right. The U.S. is trying to catch up. So they've got three supercomputers on track for 2018 that would beat this fastest supercomputer out. But China has plans for even bigger projects beyond that. So we'll see.
Yeah, you know, I used to hear who, you know, always was a race for being the top dog in supercomputing.
List. Right. Absolutely.
Let's talk about the rescue operation that was going on at the South Pole.
This is a fascinating expedition. So right now it's winter in the South Pole. It doesn't feel like it here in New York, obviously. We're in the summertime. But down there, it's negative 70 degrees Fahrenheit and very, very dark. The sun won't rise again until September. Usually, the base station down there, run by the National Science Foundation, does not even have any flights in or out between February and October of every year due to the cold and the conditions on the ground. They still have 48 people stationed down there, keeping some things like radio telescopes and other experiments on atmospheric gases running in the meantime. But this week, they had to run a rare rescue mission to recover two contractors, actually, who had become sick while working down there. They were with Lockheed Martin. And this is only the third time in history that the National Science Foundation has run one of these rare wintertime rescue operations to their South Pole base station.
Wow. I remember back in the 90s, there was a doctor stationed at the pole who was diagnosed with cancer, and they had to get the doc out.
Right, yes. And it's an extremely touch-and-go operation. So the contractors who run these expeditions for the National Science Foundation in the middle of the Antarctic winter are out of Canada, so they had to actually fly down there. They sent two planes just in case one had some trouble and they'd have to go in and do a search and rescue operation. But fortunately, they were able to make it out with the patients who landed in Chile earlier this week for medical attention.
And we don't know what was wrong with them.
We don't officially know, no. I mean, really, when you're down there, you are pretty much on your own, and they do have usually medical staff on base. So typically, it's something quite serious that, you know, would have had a risk of death if they weren't recovered before October.
Yeah, I was down there many years ago, and I can tell you how lonely it gets.
Yes,
down there.
I can
imagine.
And
they very rarely ever take anybody out because the rescue effort is very dangerous. Let's talk about that. Scientists having created what they called Franken-turtles. It's not even Halloween, and we're talking Franken-turtles.
That's right. If you live around...
Sea turtle zombies? Or what are we talking about?
Exactly. If you live around Chesapeake Bay, you may be on the lookout because these zombie or Franken-turtles might be washing up on your beaches. So there's a couple of scientists from the Virginia Institute of Marine Sciences who are working on an experiment to try to figure out the mystery of sea turtle strandings. So every year, hundreds of sea turtles wash up on the shores of Chesapeake Bay, and they've died, and we don't really know why or where these turtles are coming from.
So in the same spot? They all come to the same spot.
So they land on the beaches and they sort of tend to land on certain stretches of beach. So they're not really sure where the problem is in the ocean or where these turtles are dying off. And that's what they're trying to figure out. So to do this, they've sort of worked backward and taken a few dead sea turtles, carved out their innards, stuffed them with styrofoam to help them float, close them with zip ties, and then set them in the ocean to see how they're floating and whether ending up on the beaches. They're hoping with some software and some GPS tracking, they can actually work backward to figure out where the turtles that are landing up on the beach might have originated from.
Now, I can't imagine to make this work that anybody could have enough sea turtle carcasses in their freezer.
I know,
You're going to get out and just put them out there. They must have make something artificial, right? Sort of
That's
a mimic,
right.
A sea turtle.
So they do have a few actual carcasses that have been recovered from the beach and are still in decent enough condition, have not decayed or decomposed enough that they can use them for this experiment. But you're right, they're trying out a few other things because the carcass supply is limited, let's say. So they're trying a couple of other things called drifters. One is made out of balsa wood. It's shaped like a turtle, meant to kind of mimic how a turtle might float if it were out in the ocean on its own. And then also they're using a couple of buckets full of water, which sit just below the surface. So they're not affected by wind currents, but they travel with water currents, and those can track the ocean's movements in a different way.
Mm. The fact that these are washing up the dead sea turtles in Chesapeake Bay, is that means that they are in trouble? I mean, are they dying off in
so
a bay?
Absolutely. There's five species of sea turtle in the area, and all five are either endangered or threatened. So this is a pretty important mystery to figure out. You know, it could be due to boat strikes. It could be due to changes in the ocean, particularly cold water can, you know, cause hypothermia. Or it could be due to something else that we haven't yet discovered. Mm.
Well, thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Amy Nordrum. She is not part of the women's clothing department store anymore. Sorry to mispronounce your name.
That's okay. It happens.
Amy Nordrum, associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum here in New York. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And our story today, autonomous cars. Because wouldn't it be nice to just kick back and read the paper on your commute, sip some coffee, while your car takes care of the driving, and your car is talking to other cars, and they're all smoothly navigating out now on less crowded highways. And once you get to your destination, you just get out, and your car, it's going to park itself, of course. Great. But below the surface, things are not quite as rosy. So here to weigh the good, the bad, and the complicated is my guest, Azim Sharif. He is an assistant professor of psychology and social behavior at UC Irvine. He's one of the authors of a study out this week in the journal Science on some of the sticky moral issues, like how people feel about letting their cars decide who lives or dies in the case of an accident. He joins us by Skype. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
As I mentioned, autonomous vehicles certainly have some benefits, right? Let's talk about the good thing.
Well, they have a lot of benefits, and you mentioned some of them. I think that the one that most people think about is that idea of sipping coffee and reading the newspaper while being in the car, that convenience factor. But there's a bunch of other things which people don't think about as much. So one is fuel efficiency. Mm. These cars are going to be much more fuel efficient. Their capabilities at driving are going to be much more efficient. People who are kind of locked out of the driving business themselves, so people with disabilities, people who are blind, the elderly, they will be able to be driven easily by these cars. We're going to be able to redesign our cities, so we won't have to have all this street parking. As you mentioned, the car can drop you off and then go zip off to some sort of central parking facility and then come back and pick you up when it needs to. There's a tremendous well-being benefit. So right now, commuting is the worst part of most people's day for people who commute.
Yeah.
The psychological literature is absolutely clear on that. Commute.
I know all about that traffic. let's talk about the bad thing.
Well, there's one big good thing that I want to mention there, and that's safety. So that's probably the biggest and the most morally interesting advantage of having these cars. The estimate is that 90% of all the accidents that happen are human caused. They're the product of human error. And that kills about 30 to 40,000 people in the United States every year. So that's a tremendous benefit that we'll see with these cars. But yeah, there are some bad things. Mm-hmm. There are some bad things. So one of the big things is labor displacement, right? So these AVs, these autonomous vehicles, are going to replace a lot of jobs that are currently the human drivers, right? So Uber is trying to develop their own autonomous vehicles so they can take out that pesky human side of their business model. And you can imagine a lot of trucking companies would also be keen to do this because that's an expense and it's a lag on their efficiency. Mm-hmm. With an autonomous car, the truck can just go all night, doesn't have to rest, doesn't have to stop, and you don't have to pay the humans for doing that. So that's a negative.
Well, let's talk about the what you studied, the moral psychological angle here, the more complicated thing.
Right. So there it's a challenge of adoption. So if it's the case that these are going to be beneficial innovations, how do we get people to adopt them? And what's actually going to dissuade them from adopting them? And so in addition to replicating human capabilities, these cars are going to have to be making some value-laden moral decisions. I mentioned that it's going to reduce accidents, but it's not going to reduce all of them. And in certain accidents, these cars are going to be able to see different paths, which will apportion harm to different people involved. So they could, in one situation, if they take one option, they could harm pedestrians. But if they see another option that could actually harm the passengers, that might be, from a utilitarian perspective, the more ethical thing to do, but it involves sacrificing the very people who bought and own the car.
So you may not want to buy a car that does that.
Well, not one that's actually trying to kill you in particular situations, no.
All right. That is complicated. You're absolutely right, Azeem. Thank you for joining us. Azeem Sharif is an assistant professor of psychology and social behavior at UC Irvine. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to meet the man who got stung by bees, by wasps, by bullet ants, all for science, and what it feels like to step on a stinger, and why ranking pain is useful data. I'm getting ouch just thinking about this. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Do you remember the last time you were stung by a honeybee? Would you say that it felt burning and corrosive, or perhaps more like a flaming match head, quenched first by lye, then by sulfuric acid? Whoa. Could you assign a pain? Could you assign that pain a numerical value? Maybe just a 2, because it wasn't quite that bad. Well, my next guest has done just that, intentionally stung himself with a wide range of bees and wasps and ants, you name it, and has intricately described the pain of dozens of insect stings. Take the aggressive bullet ant, whose, quote, pure, intense, brilliant pain he compares to, listen to this, walking over flaming charcoal with a 3-inch nail embedded in your feet. And that gets a 4 on the pain scale, the highest value available, not to mention the tarantula hawk wasp. We'll talk about that one, too. So why would anybody choose such a painful profession, and what makes a bee sting useful data? Justin O'Schmidt, a biologist at the Southwest Biological Institute, adjunct facility faculty at the University of Arizona. He's the creator of the Schmidt Sting Pain Index. Yes, there is one. Author of a new book about its making called The Sting of the Wild. And we have an excerpt of Justin's book on our website at sciencefriday.com/sting. And while you're there, check out the great graphic layout of his pain scale, courtesy of the folks at Atlas Obscura. Welcome to Science Friday. Hi, are you there, Justin?
Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
Yeah.
So how many insects have you been stung by to make this scale?
Probably about 1,000 or so. I kind of run out of fingers and toes after a few dozen, but probably at least 500 honeybees and a couple hundred harvest ants, plus, well, everything else that you kind of mentioned.
That bullet ant, I was reading it in the book. I can't believe that pain. Describe that for us.
It's absolutely amazing. It's something that was written about by early naturalists, and they talked about getting themselves stung and thinking it was a snake or something like that. So I was in Brazil, and I was thinking, wow, this thing must have wonderful chemistry. And I was basically trying to understand venom chemistry and how we might be able to use this for benefit either medically or for understanding social behavior. And so I was busy digging them up. And unfortunately, there's a lot of roots. So when I hit a couple of roots, I had to sort of step back and dig a little harder, and they came boiling out. They're sticky. People don't think about that. You know, you think big, clumsy ant. Boy, they crawl right up your forceps, and wow, wham, they just nail you.
Well, so what? You also talk about the tarantula, hawk, wasp. Compare and contrast the two for me.
Yeah, they're like day and night in some regards, in that they both hurt. You know, they really hurt. The tarantula hawk, perhaps acutely more. It's like, as I say, you're walking on a windy day underneath a telephone pole, and a 20,000-volt line snaps off and lands on your arm. Now, of course, I've never had that happen, but you know, you can well imagine that. It's instantaneous, electrifying, just totally debilitating, just shuts you down entirely. But it's over in about 2 minutes, so that's the good news. There's a silver lining here. And the trench and the bullet ant, in contrast, hurts like a, like you say, a burning ember that was just rammed into you. Unfortunately, it doesn't just last 2 minutes. It goes into this crescendo, as if somebody's turning on a blowtorch and burning you. And then they kind of turn it off and let it recede for a little bit. Then they turn it on again. Imagine this going for 12 to 36 hours. And
wow.
In my case, it was only 12 hours because I knew what I was doing. I was paying right attention to the ant. It didn't sneak up on me. Mm. And I got it off before it really nailed me too hard.
Wow. So why do you do this? Why have you purposely stung yourself with thousands of bites and stings and to create this scale? What's the purpose?
Most of my stings, actually virtually all the ones that really hurt, haven't been intentional because I'm far too much of a chicken for that. But they've been in the heat of the battle, like the bullet ant. I was busy digging away, and I just simply got overwhelmed. A dozen of them coming out very agile, fast, and you can't catch them or dodge them efficiently enough, and you get stung. So that's the way most of them have been. The reason I've been doing this is trying to understand the evolution of social behavior. You know, we're a social species, but so are all ants and many wasps and many bees. And the problem they have is, how do you protect a whole bunch of nice, succulent, yummy brood, or honey in the case of bees, from big, nasty predators like us or even other animals that want to eat you? And my hypothesis was the only way you could do that was through an effective defense, and the only effective defense you had was a sting. I mean, you can imagine something a million times bigger than you, say a 50,000-ton lion attacking you. How are you going to possibly defend by scratching, kicking, and yelling and whatnot? You can't. But if you have a bazooka or a rocket equivalent, then you can. And that's kind of what the sting is.
Mm-hmm. What trends did you discover, and what kinds of insects hurt the most?
Well, the trend was pretty much as predicted, that the more you have at risk, in other words, the more individuals in your colony, then the greater would be the threat of predation. And along with that, concurrently, comes an increase in pain and, by the way, toxicity, because if you can do damage, that's an extra bonus in addition to just making the predator go ouch and go away. That's important because, think about pain, it's really just an indication of damage. It's not actually damage. And smart predators learn that. Take your local beekeeper, for example. He gets stung all the time, and he knows, you know, it's just all in a day's work, no big deal. I'm never any worse for the wear. And so he can ignore that. But of course, if you get 1,000 stings, well, that's a different matter.
You know, that was one of the most interesting parts of your book. You have a chapter on honeybees, and you mentioned that we have sort of been spoiled in America with our American honeybees, which are not native. There are no, as you say, native honeybees to the continent here, because they're so docile. We expect the rest of them. And then along came the Africanized bees, and boy, that changed what we were expecting.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of these things I called a human honeybee symbiosis, that originally it was an antagonism, until we realized after a while that, hey, you know, they're actually really beneficial. We don't want to exterminate them and eat all their product and have no honeybees left. We like honey. And then later on, we learned, oh, we like apples and we like fruit that's pollinated, almonds, and many of our finest foods are pollinated by honeybees. So we really need them. And in the process of doing this, we said, well, yeah, we kind of need bees, but, well, we don't really need the stings. We don't like all this pain. So can we have our cake and eat it too? And the solution was breeding. We bred them to get these docile, you know, almost like cows on wings. They just out there pasture, pollinating our crops or munching away on grass in the case of a cow. Hmm. And like you said, that all changed when the Africanized bees, which are the wild type, I make an analogy of something like the Cape buffalo, which is a wild relative of a cow. And you can go up to a cow and pet it. Don't do that with a Cape buffalo. You do that once in a lifetime.
Well, you only do it once.
Yes, it's most of us are petrified. I've seen them. They're very scary and much scarier than Africanized bees.
Yeah. Let's talk more about the honeybee, because you say in your book that you use the honeybee as a reference point for your scale, which ranks pain from 1 to 4. But is that how you make it objective, so that everybody feels the same instead of the scale ranking subjective? I mean, you have to have an objective way, right, of ranking it for everyone.
Exactly, and that was the whole purpose, and kind of to normalize it, to use a more technical term. Let's say you get stung by a honeybee. I don't know how much it hurts you. Right. I get stung. I know how much it hurts me, but you don't know. But we know that relative to the sting, if we each call it a 2, then if you get stung by something else, say a sweat bee, your rating may hurt you more than it hurts me or less, but relative to your honeybee sting, it'll be the same difference. In other words, much less in the case of a sweat bee, much more in the case of a bullet ant, of course, obviously. Mm. Yeah. And so that way we can anchor it to the most familiar stinging insect on Earth. Almost everybody has been stung by one, whether they liked it or not. And so we can use that as a reference point.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Our number is 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let's go to Portland, Oregon. Eric, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, yes, I had a question for your guest about, I've noticed that all stings are not the same, even like from a common yellow jacket. And I was wondering if he factors in or what comment he can make about the amount of venom or poison he actually receives from a sting. I had a sting one time that was much worse than all others.
And yeah.
Explain that.
Good question. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hi, Eric. You brought up exactly a brilliant point, because that's why there's only 4 points on the scale, because you have to kind of take an art form and attenuate that. Some yellow jackets sting you and get most of their venom in you, and others, you knock them off before they get much in it, and some are younger, they have less venom than some of the more mature ones. And it depends on where it stings you. A sting to your nose or your lips really, really hurts, whereas a sting to, you know, the back of the hand is no big deal. And a curiosity to me is that you get stung on the palm of your hand, in contrast, and it really hurts. So there's a difference in the innervation of the back and the palm of your hand. But because of this, you have all these different factors that make it so it's somewhat subjective, when we try to make it as objective as we can by using the numbers. But yes, you brought up a very good point.
Talking with Justin O. Schmidt, author of The Sting of the Wild, and in the book, it's beautifully written, Justin.
Thank you.
You're very poetic. You describe the pain of each sting very poetically. Your description of the sweat bee sounds like wine, and you describe it as light and ephemeral, almost fruity. A tiny spark has singed a single hair on your arm. How did you come up with that?
Well, I think you kind of get in a lighthearted mood, and you think, you know, all these numbers, my head's beginning to spin. And so after a while, you think, let's have some fun. And one of the things I realized is that we don't think in terms of numbers. Most of us don't. We think in terms of images and art and beauty and singing and song, this sort of thing. And I thought, that's the way our species communicates and really understands things. So wouldn't it be fun to try to apply this as kind of a artistic equivalent, where we're not really, you know, obviously doing this for you know, real scientific comparisons, because how can you compare one of my descriptions to another? That's the whole reason we had to have the numbers, because we had to be able to compare it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just as a form of communicating and making it more interesting.
Let's go to the phones to Jen in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Jen. Are you there? Jen, no. Well, let's go to Raul in Washington. Hi, Raul.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for your show, Ira.
Yes, you're welcome.
So I have a question for the doctor. So as far as when it comes to your stings and describing the pain scale, do you have something more reliable or relatable to the normal population other than electrocution, such as possibly comparing to the pain of a tattoo or maybe one of your worst injuries throughout your life that can qualify the pain description and bring it home? Right?
A lot of people have tattoos today. How would you, where on the pain scale, on your number scale, would a tattoo rate?
Wow, I wish I knew. I'm too much of a chicken to actually get a tattoo. I think of this needle, you know, poking many, many times in my skin. I say, oh, I'm not sure I want to do that.
I think you have to do that now so that we know how to compare it. Because so many people, the younger generation has a lot of tattoos. Let me just remind everybody, I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International.
Yeah,
Talking with Justin O. Schmidt, author of The Sting of the Wild. Great, great book, Justin. Come on.
Thank you. Yeah, I do have some more normal things. I have one case where a paperclip drops off the table and lands on your toe. Obviously, that's pretty trivial, and you wouldn't notice it. But I have something a little heavier, a spoon.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of you dropped a spoon onto a bare toe. You know, actually, that kind of hurts.
What number is that?
That would be a one, pretty much.
So now, honeybee is a number two.
Exactly.
So we're getting some idea of what it feels like.
And I've had sitting on a thumbtack is another one, or having a tack poke you. And most of us as rascally kids, at least when I was growing up, would put a thumbtack. I shouldn't say this. I'll give people ideas. But we'd put thumbtacks on the seat of our classmates, and they'd sit on it. And, oh, boy, you know, you were in trouble. Figure out who did that.
Mm-hmm. Do all stings have the same chemistry? I'm sure the ants and the bees, they almost have their own unique chemical formula for their venom and their sting?
Yeah, that's one of the beauties, that they're convergent on the same effect, that they really hurt, but they've all done it by different routes. It's really eerie almost. The honeybees have a peptide called melanin, and it's entirely different chemical structure from the wasps, the yellow jackets mentioned earlier. They have kinins that are similar to bradykinin, the cardiac stimulant that our body naturally makes. And then harvester ants, which really hurt, have another thing called barbadolice and another peptide that's totally unrelated. And the bullet ant is completely unique to science. It has Panera toxin. So all these things are not related at all chemically, but yet they sure do hurt, so they converged on the same solution of making pain.
One last thing. People are so afraid of getting stung by honeybees and having bad reaction to that. What are the odds that you have an anaphylactic reaction to a honeybee sting?
Yeah, the odds of an allergic reaction range anywhere from 1% to 4%. I usually say about 2% is kind of in the middle. And most of those allergic reactions aren't really what we call life-threatening. So that's the good news. If you have a 1 out of 50 chance of having a reaction, most of those will just be skin. You get kind of a rash, or you get swelling. It's really uncomfortable and that sort of thing. The more dangerous ones are where they affect your breathing and you get a lump in your throat and you can't get air. Or you have a drop in blood pressure and you faint. And so those are the ones that require some kind of medical attention. But they're really much, much rarer than most of us really imagine.
Well, we thank you for taking time to be with us. It's a fascinating book. I don't know where you go from here, except to the tattoo parlor, I think.
Yeah. Next stop.
All right. Thank you, Justin.
Well, thank you.
O. Schmidt, a biologist from Southwest Biological Institute, author of The Sting of the Wild. It's a great book. It's like nothing else you have ever read. I've read a lot of books on this program, but this is so well written and describes the pain and the variety of insects and venoms and things that are out there. We're going to take a break, and we're going to close out our week-long Cephalo Party. It's the last day of Cephalopod Week. You want to be here for the festivities. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For 8 days, we have had a nonstop cephalopod celebration. We put out the invitation, and, well, we found you're all suckers for a good cephalo party. And who wouldn't be? We got your selfies, your costumes, artwork, and I learned that an octopus has arms, not tentacles. And here to tell us all about the highlights of Cephalopod Week are Brandon Echter, Science Friday's engagement manager, and Christian Baker, an independent filmmaker and producer based in Los Angeles. Welcome back to both of you.
Hey, Ira.
Hey, Ira. How's it going?
Nice to have you back. Brandon, this is our third year of all things tentacled and armed. I'm going to add that.
It is.
What did we see this year from everybody?
Oh, man. So the big thing this year that we saw a lot of, people were submitting a lot of knit cephalopods this year. So we had a lot of...
They knit out of yarn?
Exactly. Yeah. They knit octopuses, which is the correct form.
Right. No octopi.
Yes. And squid and all sorts of stuff. But actually, which is like really awesome and fun. But the really cool thing this year is we saw a lot of researchers and museums and aquaria sharing all their really cool pictures from behind the scenes. Like the California Academy of Sciences had this great picture of one of their researchers making, like, adoring a nautilus. So, there were a lot of cephalopod geeks out there this year.
There are. And our web team wrote a few articles.
Yeah, yeah. We had a lot of stuff on sciencefriday.com this week. We had this really great Q&A with Roger Hanlon. So a couple of years ago, there was a video called Where's the Octopus?
Loved it.
It's
Laura Lichtman did that one.
Yeah, yeah. And it's basically you see this octopus like kind of hiding on a piece of coral or seaweed, and then all of a sudden it blanches and swims away. It's so cool.
It's amazing.
So we had a really good Q&A with the person who filmed that video, Roger Hanlon, who basically taught us how cephalopod camouflage works. It talked about the difference between chromatophores versus iridophores versus leucophores. Basically, they have this really complex three-layer system where you have the color organs, the chromatophores at the top, the iridophores, which are more like the polarized light, the shininess beneath it, and then this white layer, the leucophores beneath. We also have this really amazing article about a brooding squid. And I don't mean a squid that like listens to The Cure or The Smiths or anything. I mean like a squid that actually is brooding its eggs. So like last year, you remember there was this big news about an octopus that was brooding some eggs for 4 years.
Right.
Yeah. So this squid, hopefully pronounce this correctly, the Gnatis onyx. This squid was discovered in the early, around 2002, and it's basically deep in the ocean, holding onto this giant egg sac the size of its body. Thousands of eggs. It's a really like amazing picture.
It's on our website, a great photo.
Yeah, it's
up there in the article.
Amazing. It looks like it's kind of floating through space because of all the marine snow. Basically, it holds this egg sac in its mouth for 9 months, which I don't know if I could last that long without eating for 9 months, and then dies dies pretty soon after. And of course, we had an article about my personal favorite cephalopod, the flamboyant cuttlefish, which is they're weirdos. They live up to their name. They're very colorful and bright, and have sometimes put on these pulsing patterns. They do this kind of army crawl across the ocean floor, so it looks like they're dancing a little bit. But because they're so colorful, they think that a lot of people think that it's toxic. So researchers at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, they teamed up with Georgia Southern University and Utah State and actually tested to see if they are toxic. And it turns out they're not. They have some toxins, but not nearly enough to be toxic to any vertebrate.
And we also teamed up with a few organizations.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So we So the big thing this year was going behind the scenes and seeing a lot of these cephalopods and researchers in action. So we had Monterey Bay Aquarium. They gave us this really great octopus encounter on Periscope, where they basically went behind the scenes at the aquarium and met with their giant Pacific octopus. And I saw them give octopus hickeys, and it looked very painful. And I'm kind of glad it wasn't my arm being held onto it.
Wait, let me just. So while it was photographing, and the octopus grabbed onto his...
It was grabbing on to wow. all the people back there. It was giving them a big octo hug. The American Museum of Natural History also kind of took us behind the scenes. Mark Siddall, the curator of invertebrates at AMNH, took us by, let people see their giant squid. And we also teamed up with this really great organization called Squids for Kids. And basically, they're affiliated with Stanford, and they give squid anatomy demonstrations to students and kids around the country. And we got a chance to learn about the insides of a Humboldt squid, which is really cool. Like, they can lay up to like millions of eggs, Ira. It was mind-blowing. It was really cool.
And Christian Baker, you did a great video for us. You went to a lab of a researcher who is studying ink. And
that is correct.
Don't we already know that squid use ink as defense? What was the mystery? The mystery here?
That's a good question. We have known for a very long time that squids use ink as a visual defense mechanism. But Stephanie Bush, a.k.a. Dr. Cephalopod of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, began to theorize that deep-sea squids could be using ink for a number of different... they could have a number of different uses. If you consider the fact that deep-sea squids are living deep in the water column, and sunlight can't possibly penetrate that far down. So she started to wonder, what good would a visual defense system be that far deep in the water? And she started to hypothesize that squids could be releasing ink, and it could have a bitter taste, which would certainly deter a hungry predator. It could also, conversely, taste like very, very tasty, tasty squid. And more tasty than the squid itself, which could confuse a predator and buy the squid just enough time to make a hasty exit. But the possibilities go on from there. She also hypothesized, this is my favorite, of course, is that squids could be using ink as a means to attract mates. So we like to kind of think of that as if you're a deep sea squid and you release a little ink, it's kind of like creating a Tinder profile. And then you're just kind of hoping that another squid comes along and, you know, swipes right.
Well, I get the analogy, but going back to another time, I mean, if it's pretty dark down there, you can't see another squid, but maybe you could smell it, right? Or detect it by the ink it leaves out.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they're kind of hoping for, is that, hey, if I release a little ink, maybe there's another squid in the area, kind of likes how I smell, and maybe we can hook up at some point.
Don't there sometimes a squid add, let's say, a little something special to the ink?
Absolutely. Squids can also create and release mucus. So they can release mucus in mixed in with the ink. And what that does is, if you were to release just ink into the water, it would dissipate very quickly. But if they mix a little mucus into it, it kind of thickens the viscosity. And what that does is create what's known as a pseudomorph. And what that basically looks like is, if you just squirted a bunch of ink, it kind of creates and holds this shape of this dark blob. And what they, what they use that for is to, again, confuse the predator. So if something's trying to, if you're a squid and something's trying to eat you, you release this little pseudomorph, and then, the hope is that the predator says, oh, well, that kind of looks and possibly smells a little bit more squid-like than the actual squid. So.
Wow. I get it. Well, I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Brandon Echter is Science Friday's engagement manager, and Christian Baker is an independent filmmaker and producer based in Los Angeles. Thank you both for coming on today.
Thanks for cephalopoding with us, Ira.
You're welcome. It may be the last day of Cephalopod Week, but you can keep the cephalo fandom, get it, going. All the articles and videos are up on our website at sciencefriday.com. And now for our final day of Cephalopod Week, we thought we'd combine two of our favorite topics all into one super conversation. Squid, octopus, and cephalopods being one of them, of course. And if you listen to the show a lot, one of our other favorite topics is, can you guess? That's right, it's the microbiome. We might break the radio with our next guest with this. She studies the microbiome, the bacteria living inside of a squid. Sarah McAnulty is a PhD candidate in molecular and cell biology at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. Don't let her title fool you, because she is a squid nerd. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Fine. You study the bacteria in the Hawaiian bobtail squid, and not the bacteria in the gut, but in its light sac. Why and how does that work?
So on a surface level, the symbiosis itself is just really, it's a neat approach to nocturnal camouflage. Because when you think about squid, octopus, and cuttlefish from a predator's eye view, they're basically like swimming protein bars. They don't have any bones or shells to break down, and that makes for a really easy, convenient meal. So as a result, they've gotten really good at camouflaging. So these nocturnal bobtail squid use light from bacteria as a means of camouflaging, and this is called counterillumination. So normally, sharks or fish swimming at night often look up and look to find a silhouette of a prey item above, and then will strike. But these squid have found a way to match the moonlight with light created by bacteria. So these bacteria live in a specialized organ on the underside of the squid called the light organ. And these squid can actually control the amount of light that shines from their light organ. So if it's a bright night with a full moon, no clouds, they can let a lot of that bacterial light out. But if it's a cloudy night, they can actually use their ink sac as a kind of shutter to obscure that light. Regardless of the weather conditions, they are hidden.
So what makes these bacteria so special, so unique that you want to study them?
What's great about this system to study is that we have just one species of bacteria in this organ, and then the squid immune system is also relatively simple compared to ours. So these squid just have an innate immune system, which just sort of simplifies our experiments. Additionally, we can raise these squids separate from the bacteria if we want to, which makes for a nice tractable system. So it's neat just to think about a squid that glows, but at the molecular level, it's really fascinating, and it's a really convenient model to study symbiosis.
And you're interested in the immune system, so what do these bacteria have to do with the immune system?
So what our lab and our collaborating labs are trying to understand is the language that the immune system and bacteria are using to communicate. So immune cells, be them from squid, humans, mice, anything, need to be very effective at hearing what the microbes in their environment have to say. And bacteria need to be able to produce molecules in order for those immune cells to hear them. So bacteria communicate through molecules that we call MAMPs, or microbe-associated molecular patterns, and immune cells listen using proteins that we call pattern recognition receptors. So what I'm studying in this squid is focusing on the pattern recognition receptors that are present on the surface of immune cells, because previously our lab has shown that the immune cells from these squid can actually tell the difference between their symbiont, Vibrio fischeri, this bioluminescent bacterium, and closely related bacteria that they would find in their environment. And this is kind of crazy to think about, because these squid only have the innate immune system. They don't have the complicated adaptive immune system that's present in vertebrates, so they don't have antibodies or traditionally specific molecules that we think of. So what we're trying to piece together is how, using this simple immune system, they can be so specific.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Sarah McAnulty from University of Connecticut in Storrs about the squid and the microbiome inside. A squid has blue blood, correct? Is this similar to horseshoe crab's blood that's used?
It's very similar.
Yeah, medical testing. Yeah.
Oh, so the reason that both squid blood and horseshoe crab blood is blue is that it has a oxygen binding protein called hemocyanin. And hemocyanin has copper in it, which gives it kind of like a blue tint. So unlike vertebrate blood, hemocyanin will flow freely through the bloodstream. Hemoglobin in humans is restricted to red blood cells, as I'm sure many of the listeners know. Now, the reason that you can use horseshoe crab blood for medical testing is because the immune cells in that blood will aggregate if contamination is present. I think you probably could do that with squid blood, although I personally have never tried it. I'm not really sure if anyone has. But our squid are about like the size of a ping pong ball, so it might be a little challenging to make that financially reasonable.
How'd you get to be such a squid geek?
Well, I've been interested in squid ever since I was a little kid. I remember one time my mom rented this tape out of the library, out of just on the ocean in general, and there was this one segment of the video where Twilight Zone music played, and they introduced the broad club cuttlefish. So the broad club cuttlefish does something pretty cool. It uses this hypnotic pattern of black and white stripes that move along the squid's or the cuttlefish's body as it swims to kind of hypnotize the prey before it strikes. And pretty much right from then, I haven't been able to get enough of cephalopods.
Well, you know, there's a good focus for us for next year, that cuttlefish. Maybe we'll, on next year's Cephalopod Week, we can look a little bit more at that. Maybe you'll help us out next year if you like cephalopods so
sure.
much. Yeah.
Yeah.
Give us some more information about what. So what do you want to know more about the squid that you don't know already?
That's a good question. I guess what I'm really interested in is just the mechanism of recognition in these cells. Because as we're learning more about immune systems, we're realizing that it's a lot more complicated than just a non-self recognition. So an immune cell typically would be thought of to interact with a new bacterium or whatever, and then attack. But we're realizing that sometimes these cells will interact with a bacterium and do something beneficial to the microbe. So our collaborators recently have published that immune cells in squid will actually enter the light organ. They'll sort of survey the light organ to make sure everyone who's present is supposed to be. But at some points during the day-night cycle, specifically at night when these bacteria are bioluminescing, the immune cells will actually kind of sacrifice themselves for the cause and feed the symbionts
wow.
within. And I think that's kind of crazy, because if you told an immunologist 30 years ago, they might have thought you were nuts to say that an immune cell is helping a microbial population. So kind of understanding more about the dual role of the immune system being more of a negotiator than an attack dog is, I think, a really cool thing that we can really pin down with this system.
Yeah, science is cool. Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, no problem.
Good luck. Sarah McAnulty Thanks. Is a PhD candidate in molecular and cell biology at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. That's about all the time we have for this hour. Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners at the City University of New York. Just a reminder, if you haven't heard for the last 20 minutes, it's the end of Cephalopod Week. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. See all these cool cephalopods up there. They'll be up there forever now. I guess they're on the internet. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.